and welcome to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Sam's off this week because we're exhausted. You got me. Somehow I'm on this week. I'm Becky Friedman, and with me in the studio are Dan and Nathan. How are you guys?
Hey, good.
Doing great.
Not so exhausted. You're doing good, and you're doing great because you weren't working at camp all week, were you?
Not remotely. Nope.
I'll tell you, after 8 years of volunteering at Camp Quest Northwest, I wouldn't have it any other way. But as a 37-year-old, your knees are a little bit more shaky, and your ankles are a little bit more achy, and your head is a little bit more clouded. Man, kids running around, they have you running around, and you get physically tired. I will tell you that. But it was an amazing, awesome week for us at Camp Quest Northwest at one of our newest locations, Camp Waskowitz. And that was really cool because we're very used to having a waterfront campsite. And now we have a very riparian, mountainous kind of campsite, which was definitely super awesome and cool. And I think that, I don't know, overall it was super fun. But at the same time, I kind of shut off for the whole week regarding the outside world. So what the heck happened this week?
So on the 4th of July independence theme, the ramparts were rammed, so to speak.
And the airports were taken.
Yeah, in the Revolutionary War. Although I think
our Revolutionary War?
Yeah. Although I think he was actually talking about some other incursion that was actually, I think, part of the War of 1812.
That's right.
Which is actually, in some ways, really our Independence Day, which, by the way, for all you French veterans out there, thank you for, Independence Day. Yeah, here.
And so right. By the mystery he that you're referring to is none other than
Individual One.
Okay.
Donald right. Trump.
Airports were taken, the rockets flared, and the flag was still there.
Yep.
Was this a new? Did he sing this as part of the anthem? Did he forget the words? What is this?
They've been calling it the Forgettysburg Address. Yeah.
Yeah. Apparently, George Washington was
across the Delaware right into LaGuardia National.
So should we be actually, criticizing Trump on this? I mean, Stephen Miller's his speechwriter, right? Shouldn't
well,
we be?
Well, except for it was raining on Donnie's parade, which is always great when that happens. Well, and the teleprompter, he blamed that on the weather too. Although he totally had it. Did not need the teleprompter, but of course he messed up because the teleprompter shorted
got
or
wet
something.
Or something.
Okay, yeah. So the teleprompter didn't actually prompt him to say that George Washington crossed the Delaware to LaGuardia Airport.
Or whatever, yeah.
It did and it didn't. We have a quantum Trump teleprompter problem where where he does not need the teleprompter, but the teleprompter caused him to misspeak.
What else kind of happened this week? I mean, is there anything good is it just full ridiculosity?
No, there's some good stuff too. Here in Washington, the Nooksack Dam is scheduled to come down next year. That's a large dam on the Nooksack River. It's about 25 feet high and about 100 feet wide. Certainly not the biggest dam in the state, but it is large enough to block salmon migrations. That dam coming down is going to open up dozens of miles of Chinook salmon habitat, so one of our most critically endangered fishes here in Washington, and the sole food source for our southern resident orcas. The southern residents have been missing from the Salish Sea area for about 8 weeks, and they were just spotted. The new calf in J-Pod that we heard about earlier this spring was still with them, so the calf is surviving so far. We're calling the calf J56. No name yet, but it's been identified as female. And the mom appears to be J31 Tsuchi. This is her first successful pregnancy. So this could actually bode well for the southern residents. The salmon returns in California have been significantly higher than expected, which is great news. So maybe that's why the southern residents haven't been around these waters. Hopefully they've been down hunting someplace with more fish to eat.
So when we say that they haven't been spotted, or they hadn't at least been spotted for about 8 weeks, what's the significance behind that?
At this time of year, it's very common to find all three pods, J-pod, K-pod, and L-pod, all three southern resident pods of orcas here in the Salish Sea. They're hunting the salmon returning to the Fraser River and some of the North Sound rivers as well. But this year they've been absent through most of the season that we would be usually seeing them here, probably tied to the low salmon returns. But if the salmon returns have been better someplace else, you can't blame them for going where the food is.
Okay. All right. So that's some good news then. And should we happen to spot any of the orcas, what would be the best behavior from us from a human perspective?
Best behavior, keep your distance. That means be at least 400 yards away from the southern residents at all times. If you can't tell the difference between a southern resident orca and a transient orca, err on the side of residents and keep as far off as you're able.
Are transient orcas intermixing with our resident orcas, or will we see those transients as well?
Transients are, you could think of them as effectively a different species. They are not a population with any crossover with the southern residents. Totally different behavior patterns, totally different language, totally different diets. Their evolutionary history seems to be separated by about 11,000 years. Transients have been coming into the Salish Sea a lot more than they used to in previous years. So we're starting to see a lot more transients and a lot less residents. These things probably aren't really tied to each other. The marine mammals are still here that the transients would like to eat. The salmon that the residents would like to eat are not so much here, so probably more of a dietary thing than anything else. But if you see some orcas, assume they're residents and keep your distance unless you have a guide with you that knows otherwise. And that means keeping 400 yards off, and I believe it's if you're within a half a mile of them, your top speed should be no more than 7 knots.
So when we see these amazing pictures, you know, online and social media or in local newspapers of folks in their kayaks with, you know, an orca right there, are we allowed to sort of chase them down and paddle over to them?
Not allowed to chase them down and paddle over to them, but part of the difficulty is, you know, we don't want boats in their way. We don't want them to be bothered by engine noise or by human interference in any way. However, if they're coming at you, once they're within 400 yards of you, your engine has to be off. And that means if they're coming towards you, you can't really do much about it.
Except enjoy their beauty and amazingness?
Right. And sometimes they sort of pop up too close by surprise. If they're headed your way and they're outside of 400 yards, you should try to get out of their way. But if they pop up by surprise, you know, shut off your engines and try not to bother them. If you have the chance to leave within a half an hour, we recommend that you do that too. We don't want boats on them for too long, so...
Nice. Okay. So super cool things that we should keep our eyes peeled for as we're out and about in our summer activities around the water and around the sound, or the Salish Sea, as many of us are calling it, if I'm getting our facts correct.
Calling the waterway the Salish Sea is an homage to the indigenous peoples who have lived here for at least 10,000 years, probably longer. And the Salish Sea sort of includes the inland waterways between Vancouver Island and British Columbia. It also includes the Strait of Juan de Fuca, the Strait of Georgia, Rosario Strait, Haro Strait. So it's kind of like the all one name for the sort of regional waterway that we have here.
Neat. Sounds good. So I heard that there was some sports happening. I mean, I know right now we're sort of in a baseball lull because it's the Home Run Derby and All-Star Game Week and all those kinds of things. But there's some other sports that happened this week.
Yeah, the U.S. soccer team won because we have an awesome soccer team. You know, we also have a men's soccer team. They did not win this year, but but the U.S. soccer team won, and they're really great. Yeah.
So one of the things that did come across, even in my somewhat disconnected state, was that there was great celebration. And it's traditional for some of our national, leading sports teams to be invited to the White House. And I think most of the players feel that they would give that a miss. If I'm correct.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's obviously some kind of tradition. You know, Obama he's kind of a sports guy. He's really he's a basketball player, but, you know, even before then, traditionally, it's, you know, presidents are there to, you know, receive signed footballs, unless you're Trump, and then you just get the regular helmet, not the signed helmet. But
that's what you get for serving Burger King.
Yep. But you know, obviously the U.S. Soccer team, as well as the Netherlands team, are both some of the most inclusive as far as members that are gay within the soccer team. And so that's pretty widely known. Rapinoe is kind of been throwing some shade at Trump, saying, hey, you know, if you were to invite us, we're not going to go. And then Trump's like, well, you got to win first. And so obviously now the ball, the soccer ball is now in the court of Donald Trump to try to like post hoc something.
Right. Yeah. Rapinoe was actually asked if she planned to go to the White House after the win. And
she had some expletive
using an expletive. She gave a response in the negative.
As did the French bar members.
Right. And people have said that...
French bar members? What's this? French bar members said
this
no?
is on... Yeah, it's on Fox News. There's a local... They're in France because, you know, this is a big worldwide event. And so there is, you know, some F Trump chanting is going on in the background. And because that was on Fox News, then that caught the eye of individual one as well. And so he was not very happy about that. But so now Fox News is worse than CNN, more fake.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
This could change the entire course of American politics.
I'm looking forward to it. And you go away for a week and this all happens.
Exactly.
Right. One of my favorite things that's come out of this is that Rapinoe was criticized for using an expletive when talking about the White House. But, you know, it was in a locker room. And I understand that locker room talk is off limits for censorship.
It was literally in a locker room, too. It was great. Yeah.
So I go away for a week and all those awesome things happen. We also got a comment from Gary from the internet, who gave us some little bit of feedback and a question. And I'd love for us to give this a little shot here. Gary says, I'm an atheist, not a 100% confident atheist, because I still have unanswered questions. For example, I've heard of some religions preaching God is self. And I've studied all religions, including being an atheist, knowing that they could all be false. I believe that the answer lies in the middle of the combined knowledge. Now, if you believe in evolution, you believe 2 billion years ago, we were single-celled organisms. So 2 billion years from now, we will be as different from single-celled organisms as we are today. Atheists love to ask, if God created us, then who created God? Well, if there is no God, what if there is no God? Because we are God creating itself. Would love to discuss my theory further. I just don't have the media outlet like you do to get my idea out there. Nathan, first thoughts on Gary's musings.
I mean, it's a little all over the place, but it does sound very pantheistic or what were we mentioning? Cosmotheistic
or different naturalistic pantheism, different things like that.
Right. And it's sort of like, well, there isn't maybe this external God, but you can maybe redefine. And, you know, it's a lot of people struggle with this as it kind of ties into meaning. Part of my deconversion, certainly for a hot minute, I jumped into the pantheistic. Stepping stone. It's probably the most common one, I would think.
So you started as Lutheran, as you've shared here.
Yes, ELCA,
And then as your exit was there, it kind of your conception of God kind of expanded beyond the Christian Lutheran.
Well, so you know, I'm in confirmation and you know, actually studying the Bible and actually reading it and thinking about things, and you kind of get a little bit more we got exposed to a lot of other denominations. That was one of the things that the leaders, the youth leaders and the interim pastor we had was really into. I mean, these are like hippie Lutherans, right? So they're very inclusive. And so they wanted to go out and learn from all these other denominations. And when you see all the differences, you get to the point where it's like, well, these people are Unitarian. These people are Trinitarian. These people aren't really very big into the Old Testament. These people are really big into baptism. And you see all these different things. And if that starts to bring your worldview to higher and higher altitude, and then you're like, wait, I'm kind of a pantheist now.
Okay.
And
for me, it was sort of always like, I was inspired when I stumbled upon Baruch Spinoza at age 14, and I was like, oh, this makes sense. And look, Spinoza was Jewish, so this is just a different way to be Jewish, because I grew up in a very pluralistic Jewish environment. My grandparents, though, my paternal grandparents were very, very observant. My grandfather was actually a sort of temple paraclergy member, so not ordained as a rabbi, but would be the one to tutor all kids for their bar mitzvah. That's the coming of age ceremonies. He would be there ensuring that there was quorum for morning and evening prayers for everyone. And you know, and seeing that there was a different way to be Jewish, I kind of latched onto that. Similar to what Gary had said, like, what if there isn't God, that's a separate thing, but God is, you know, we are part of God, the universe is part of God. So, you know, I think it was when I was sitting with Sam, and he said, well, that's not Judaism, that's pantheism. And that was the first time I'd ever sort of thought about that or even heard that. And then I was like, okay, well, it's Judaism Or it's pantheism flavored with matzo ball soup or something like that, right. You know, and sprinkled with Yiddishisms in there. And I think that what Gary is looking at right here is the initial and might be the initial phases of studying a lot of religions, just like you had been exposed, Nathan, to a lot of denominations within Christianity. Looks like Gary's had a little tour of different religions and saying, you know, maybe it's not someone that I think that Gary's not saying it's a, you know, he's not a strong atheist. He's not willing Correct. To say there definitely is no God. And the fact is, there are a lot of atheists who are not strong atheists to say there is no God. Most of us say there's just no evidence to believe that there is a God. And so I act and believe as if there isn't. And it seems to work pretty well. We use other principles to guide our morality and how we interact with the world around us and the people around us and things like that. What do you think, Dan?
You know, this kind of makes me think of some of the musings that I had when I was sort of leaving my church as well. That maybe religion wasn't quite as formal and hierarchical and following, you know, these specific set doctrinal rules that I was taught that it did, because it was mostly, you know, questioning those doctrinal rules that sort of got me doubting in the first place. That some of the rules just don't make sense. Some of the guidelines just don't make sense. Some of the commandments just don't make sense. This is kind of like a lot of the stuff that I thought about, that I had friends who were Mormons and I had friends who were Buddhists and I had friends who were pagans and Wiccans and we would talk about these things. And I kind of felt like, yeah, you know, maybe the real truth of the matter is somewhere in between all this stuff. And I think what I settled on is more that human beings just have more in common because we're human beings, not because of any particular spirituality or religion. We are very similar in structure. Our cultures are very similar in structure. Our brains are very similar in structure. So we're going to be coming across the same ideas. One thing I want to pick out real quick here about the evolution time frame.
And Gary had said, you know, we started out 2 billion years ago as single-celled organisms. I would argue that we weren't right. single-celled
I mean,
organism,
not,
but our ancestors.
Not us, but
we weren't fish
yeah.
yet.
And really, it was about 3.5 billion years ago, and it seems like every year they push it back another 100 million years or so.
As we discover evidence?
As we discover more evidence for early single-celled life. And we being life on Earth, stayed single-celled for about 3 billion years before we started to see larger, complex, multicellular life forms. This is fairly recent in Earth's history. The Cambrian explosion was only about 550 million years ago. Not actually a real big chunk of time on this planet. It's about, you know, 1/8-ish of the amount of time that Earth has been around.
So is there anything to suggest that 2 billion years in the future, humans will change dramatically and drastically?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there are creatures that have appeared to have changed very little over a very long time. If you're looking at fish, you might look at sturgeons or sharks or ratfish. You might call them chimeras or ghost sharks, have changed very, very little over hundreds of millions of years. You might see things like brachiopods or crinoids that have changed very, very little over hundreds of millions of years. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to be that different. Humans are doing something a little bit odd that we don't really have much of a precedent for in the evolutionary record. And that is, rather than adapting to our world, we are adapting our world to us. As me and Nathan were joking earlier, you know, that the idea of human forms changing a whole lot probably ended about the same time that we invented eyeglasses and ergonomic tools. We make tools to make up for our shortcomings that, you know, 20,000 years ago would have killed us in the wild. So, you know, it's really hard to say. We don't know what's going to happen in the next 2 billion years. Maybe we'll be in space. Maybe we'll adapt to living in space.
Yeah, and when you start talking about billions of years, then there is going to be some major differences within that time scale as far as what the sun is doing. And
right.
And, you know, we don't know exactly what the selective pressures are going to be. You know, humans are only, what, like a couple million years old as far as anything that sort of even is close to a modern human. I mean, we're not 2 billion years old, so 2 billion years is a long time compared to 2 million years. So
right, yeah. I mean, even our hominid ancestors were only 2.5-3.5 million years ago.
Yeah.
So how different are we going to be? That's really hard to say. We're trying this adapting our environment to us instead of us adapting to the environment experiment, and Well, I don't know. Maybe we'll get rid of stuff like chairs or, you know, repetitive stress injuries or, you know, the things that sort of baffle us now. But, you know, we've already defeated the saber-toothed cats and the mastodons and pneumonia and the things that, you know, have been the real killers through most of our evolution. We've just about got malaria up against the ropes. And, well, once that happens, what's really going to select against us anymore besides other humans?
Well, and to say, to be fair, there will always be different mutations that will occur.
Of course.
I mean, I think we've talked about one of the more recent mutations within humans is the ability to keep digesting milk sugars into our adulthood, right?
Right.
So we could say, hey, because we have the ability to adapt our environment to us, any of those mutations that might occur might be some of those things that diversify us and diversify our species.
Perhaps.
Whereas, you know, maybe in the past, those mutations would have killed us off or would have been beneficial and changed us. But now we can. And who knows what might happen with the advent of genetic engineering as well.
We could CRISPR ourselves into a interesting future.
Yeah, there have been several strains of bacteria and fungi found recently that are able to digest petroleum-based plastics. That's a pretty new, cool thing. And, you know, maybe we'll find a way to incorporate them into our gut biome so we can all eat our fruit rolls with the wrappers on. Who knows what's going to happen?
I don't know that I'm too keen on eating our plastic wrapping
good.
With it. I'll settle on ice cream cones having been invented as the original wrapper and container that is edible. I'll stick to ice cream cones.
Besides tortillas?
Okay. Oh, yeah, tortillas too, yeah.
I dare say the tortilla predates the ice cream cone.
I believe you are correct. So I also want to give a shout out to a few others who have had these kinds of explorations in terms of what is, you know, existence and whether God exists or not. Is it even necessary to call it God if the entire universe or humanity is God creating itself? Things like that. Oh, you know, we've got tons of philosophers throughout time and across the world. We've got, you know, Rousseau and romantic poets all the way to Gene Roddenberry. And we've got Matthew Fox and let's see, Chuang Tzu and different scientists and the Gnostics from the Christian traditions. We've got Hildegard of Bingen, who was a mystic Catholic philosopher as well. We've got Mahayana Buddhism. We've got Ralph Waldo Emerson. We've got Parmenides. So these kinds of ideas, I think it's testament to what you were saying, Dan, that our cultures are similar, our brains are similar, so we're going to stumble across the same kinds of ideas. And I'm glad that you've started, Gary, to research different religions and come to your own consensus on where these kinds of ideas are and what they mean for either you personally or whether it informs a little bit of your flavor of atheism. Because it just also goes to show that there's many different kinds of atheists that will believe in all kinds of different things. The chief foremost one is probably isn't a god. You're listening to Ask an Atheist. We'll be back after the break. You can find us, though, at atheist.radio. Shelley Siegel's back in celebration of her new release, Holy. Shelley has embarked on a North American West Coast tour at the Swiss Restaurant and Pub in downtown Tacoma. Shelley goes on around 6 p.m. Presented by Humanists of Washington and Ask an Atheist with Sam Malvi, this event is open to the public. Families welcome. If you can't make it on Sunday, July 14th, catch her one day earlier at the Community Unitarian Universalist Church in Pasco, Washington. More information can be found at shelleysiegel.com or at atheist.radio. Welcome to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Today you got me, Becky Friedman, along with Nathan and Dan. And while this theme of our music usually precedes a segment on the best words that one Donald Trump usually says, this is a little bit broader than just the words that Donald Trump says. This has to do with something that has really been affecting me in a way that not many worldwide historical events or different things have affected me. The widespread media attention to atrocious and inhumane conditions that migrant families and unaccompanied children are facing has really struck a nerve with not just me, but seemingly really disparate factions of America and the world for that matter. But we've got secular humanists, we've got Baptists, we've got Lutherans and Jews and Democrats and Republicans. And if you believe it, even fans of Gwyneth Paltrow's Goop network are really rallying around this one thing. So usually these folks that would be diametrically opposed in so many things, whether it's the existence of God or whether, you know, weird pseudoscience works, we're all agreeing that what we're seeing here and what has been going on with the Trump administration's treatment of migrant children and migrant families is atrocious. And a friend posted to social media last week on a Saturday night, if tomorrow's sermon isn't about America's concentration camps, you go to the wrong church. Well, as an atheist, I don't have a church, and I can't really sermonize. This show isn't about sermonizing. It isn't about proselytizing. I'm not trying to get anyone to become an atheist, but it's about hearing the opinions and experiences and stories and comments of a panoply of atheists. Don't quite have a panoply, but we got three of us here today. But I'm going to start by sharing my opinions in a way that we don't typically do on Ask an Atheist, because we have things that we usually just talk about in general, but this is something that is beyond the general, like, let's look at this particular news story or event and laugh at it and see what the problem is here. This is something that is greater than that. We have migrants that arrive at the U.S. border right now, and it is completely legal to present oneself for asylum. You are seeking refuge in a place because where you are coming from is so tremendously difficult that you must seek shelter and safety elsewhere. This is a theme that is found in many religious traditions, but from a secular humanistic perspective, it's there as well. So families wait on the Mexico side. We've been seeing them in the media. They're waiting under tarps or Mylar blankets. They're sleeping on gravel or on pavement. You know, the folks on the northern Mexico side are doing their best as volunteers. We have people from the U.S. that are increasingly being held up at Customs and Border Patrol for their work, their activist work that they're doing, helping folks that are waiting on the Mexico side. You have reports that there's really a very informal list, that there's a notebook that's written down with names and ages and home cities of folks that are waiting, depending on what port of entry you're presenting yourself at. You know, it's kept at the front of the line. U.S. officials at one Arizona port of entry said back in March that they were processing an average of one family a day. Some days more, some days none. And by all accounts, that hasn't really changed. So you start at the Customs and Border Patrol Center. People are meant to stay there a minimum of 3 days. That's what those ports of entries with Customs and Border Patrol are designed for. They aren't hotel or lodging facilities. They just aren't, because you're meant to be there for 3 days. And they were designed when the majority of folks that were presenting themselves at the border for processing were single men seeking work. And Department of Homeland Security has said that ICE is at its maximum capacity of about 52,000. And they argue that it's because of this ongoing surge of migrants at the border. So Border Patrol is being ordered to hold people for far longer. And all these facilities are overcrowded and unsanitary. And that's the news that we've been seeing. That's those horrifying pictures and accounts of 90 people in a room meant for 23 or 500 people in a room meant for 70. And these rooms are just giant rooms. There may be one toilet in the corner, and there's families together and folks standing atop those toilets just to be above head level to get some air. The temperature differentials in these different processing rooms are humongous. It can be stifling in 90 degrees in one place and then 55 degrees in what's being called the ice box. Where you get a Mylar blanket on pavement. You know, ICE used to routinely parole individuals and family members and sponsors in the U.S. while they awaited their immigration hearings, which include asylum claims. And under the Trump administration, he's put an end to that for the most part as one big political gesture. There's 900, you know, in May, in the spring, there were 900 migrants in custody at El Paso Station, where there was meant to be 125 people. You're in standing room only for weeks, despite the 72-hour rule. The staff that's there has a policy of discarding all detainee property, leaving minimal clothing, because the policy says that anything wet could be bug-infested or muddy, and it presents a quote-unquote biohazard. We don't want any kinds of illnesses, spreading amongst people, especially when they're in such close quarters. But you'll see people that are coming with their entire life's possessions, and all of them are discarded. We know that there's limited access to toilets. We know that the agents are routinely requesting more resources, like portable trailers for kids to play in and kids to lie down in, even while families are processed. and extra supervisors and diapers and menstrual hygiene products and toiletries. And all of those have been denied. All of those Customs and Border Patrol requests have been denied. Whereas in the upper echelons of our legislative, you know, mess, we say, oh, there is no money. The Democrats won't approve more money for this, so we can't give you basic things like sanitary pads or diapers for toddlers. We know that we've seen ICE detention centers where families are still being separated. There was no halt to the policy of family separation. And we know that children were being asked to care for other children. Imagine being a 14-year-old young woman from Guatemala. You have recently given birth. You have your own infant who has been stripped of all their clothing. You don't get any kinds of things except for water and basic rice. And you are required to keep your infant child alive breastfeeding. And your supervisor, while you are in a cage, gives you three more toddlers and say, here, care for them. You don't know them. You don't know. They may not even speak your language. They may not be fluent in Spanish, because a lot of the people that are coming for asylum are from marginalized indigenous communities. We have in Oklahoma an army base that was used during World War II to detain Japanese Americans in what have been called internment camps in a lot of history books. I am personally friends with survivor of the Japanese American incarceration. She calls them incarceration camps. And we know that there have been folks that have protested, survivors from the World War II detentions that have been protesting. We know that those are operated by the Department of Homeland Security. And here's where it gets scary for me. Under the Department of Defense, the military can actually deny access to media and inspectors from branches of government, from family visitors, from lawyers. And they exist in restricted airspace. So you can't even have drones that go over to photograph and document what's happening. So all of this is incredibly worrisome for me. For me, as a grandchild of individuals whose family members perished in the Holocaust, and the grandchild of individuals who fled Germany seeking asylum elsewhere and who were actually denied asylum in the United States. My grandparents were denied that. They went to what was then Palestine under British rule. Other family members went to England and other family members went to Argentina. So from a personal heritage perspective, it affects me. From a personal modern contemporary perspective, these are my students. I teach in South King County. I have, for the past 8 years, routinely had a handful of students every year that come into the United States as unaccompanied minors. And for a long time, under the Obama administration, these children, they are teenagers, but they are still minor children, would be placed in foster homes and then would be enrolled in school. Because we have longstanding case law that says that children cannot be denied access to educational services, regardless of their country of origin, their national origin. That's why all children, whether they're documented or not, are allowed to enroll in school. And we have these children now warehoused in former Walmarts or, Home Depot, big box stores, with literally our administration saying, we don't have to pay for education or recreation or anything other than the basics, which is patently unconstitutional and illegal. And it's something that is so viscerally upsetting to me. And Nathan, I want to bring you in on this a little bit, because I know that you've been pretty active in some online discussions and pretty well read on a lot of the different facts and things like that. What are the things that people are saying about why this is happening? What are sort of the excuses that people seem to be repeating and giving about why we have children and families being separated and then warehoused in concentration camps?
So you brought up the money issue, and that's certainly something, they're trying to distract from, they're trying to change the conversation to, hey, this is really more about Congress needs to approve money. But of course, we all know that the Trump administration put us into this mess with the zero tolerance policy, with some other child separation things that were supposedly stopped but have not been. So a lot of these policies have nothing to do with Congress. Congress was not involved in any single word of the zero tolerance policy, for example. So there's
those things are, there's a lot of apologetics to sort of distract, because, you know, this is a really heavy subject. You know, it is really difficult for a regular person to think about this problem. It's huge, and we're creating it ourselves. You started off with the process of asylum within the United States. If you want to apply for asylum, you have to do so inside the United States. So if you, but the thing is, it doesn't actually matter how you come in. You could come in from outer space, you know, into the middle of America first. You could come here and be the most hardened, you know, criminal. I mean, they're going to, you know, hopefully weed that out, but you can come in as whoever you are in whatever fashion, but you have to be here to actually apply for asylum. So that's the first step. And that's obviously something, you know, a lot of these people I talk to don't really understand what the process even looks like in the real world. So, you know, we have all these families that are waiting at the border. They're trying to get in through legal ports of entry, which is how most people come in anyway, especially through the airports. And, you know, because a lot of these, especially unaccompanied minors, have family in the U.S., whether they're documented or not. But, you know, that asylum process is a process, and we have laws to handle that. And those are being just grossly discarded, in my opinion, based on the policies of, you know, DHS and Border Patrol, ICE.
One of the things that I've seen, and Dan, I don't know if you've seen this also, is folks saying, well, Obama was actually the deporter in chief. And so Trump is not deporting people. He's at least giving them the basics here. Have you guys seen that?
Oh, definitely. I've heard that as well. Yes.
So for me, while Obama may have definitely deported millions, that is a fact, more than George W. Bush.
Correct.
And still more than Trump's current deportation rate. He didn't set up these kinds of policies in camps. He did set up actually camps for migrant youth when there was a historic surge of unaccompanied minors coming from Central American countries.
Correct.
Those were teenagers. And those were some of the students that I ended up getting, because they were homed through foster families or sponsors through the Office of Refugee Resettlement. But that process has been completely distorted and halted since then. And at the same time, Trump is using over and over this racist and dehumanizing rhetoric to flare up tensions and drum up this emotional support for ending basically what I can see as all non-white immigration. I mean, he's threatening mass arrests and then pulling back. You know, that happened just at the end of June. He said, yeah, I'm going to start with mass arrests in major cities. OK, yep. Cool. All right. And then saying, oh, no, just kidding. I'm going to give Democrats 2 weeks to sort it out. That is a terror tactic. That's no policy.
Yeah, that's a very Russian propaganda type thing, which Trump is a very big proponent of as well, which is, I'm just going to say both really horrible things. And this is like this is also a sales tactic that's used. It affects people on a lot of different levels. But basically, you can say, hey, I'll sell you the cell phone for $1 million. And then $1 million. OK, I'll just sell it for you for $200. OK, well, that sounds pretty reasonable, even though this is a $100 phone and I just ripped you off. You're making it sound much worse, and it creates a lot of chaos. And then they can also try out all these different talking points and see what sticks. So you have some things like the raids. Those ended up partially gotten pulled back, I think, because there are some core conservatives that see active raids in U.S. cities, even though ICE is trying to target illegal immigrants. They do largely see a problem with that, because how are you getting these people? Are they on lists? You know, there's still
Republicans that are wary about personal privacy issues.
Correct. and you know, these are still conspiracies. You have the government rounding up people that are here. What does that look like? I mean, it is a slippery slope, and there's some recognition there. You know, you had mentioned the ORR, and that when they talk about funding, a lot of people, especially on the right, are focused on funding ICE, because they're the ones that are the main police force, and they have these insanely profitable, not for us, but for the private contractors. These are just
more locally. We're talking Geo Group
for here in Tacoma,
our Northwest Detention Center.
Yeah. And it's, you know, the money that these people get is insane. You know, the amount of money that we spend as Americans on, you know, if we were to spread all this money across all the Border Patrol agencies that we do, and if we were just basically to average that out per migrant that comes over the border, it's something like $700 per migrant per day. Man, woman, child. It's, you know, it's a huge amount of money. And to say, you know, we have Sarah Fabian from George Washington Law. I do want to give a shout out to them for
you know, their ethics course that they have there, trying to say that, you know, soap, toothbrushes, and blankets are not something that is covered under the basic amenities that would be required. And, you know, they should be able to supply whatever they kind of deem that they have. And it's not really a big deal if they're not doing all the basics, because all they have to do is kind of barely, you know, account for, or they have to barely follow this law. And, you know, when you have a lawyer that's arguing for this, it's grossly unethical.
For me, from a child development perspective, I look at what is the basics of having a scared child that has been separated from their family and put into what amounts to a dog cage with lights
on. It's a concentration camp.
The basics there, I could forego soap. I honestly could. I could forego soap, but a child needs, as part of their regular development, a very basic essential need is human contact, is relationships, is consistency, when you have so much inconsistency. And for what is good reason, initially, any of the folks supervising these children aren't allowed to touch the children. Now, we have had reports of children being assaulted and abused. And so the solution that they've engineered is that no one is allowed to touch the children. Well, that's how you end up getting your adult supervisors handing a 14-year-old young girl a 3-year-old and a 4-year-old to care for them. Because, well, if I can't touch you, we know that a toddler needs to be hugged and comforted. So apparently, I guess this 12-year-old or this 8-year-old can hug and comfort this other little kid. That, to me, I could forego soap if we had some kind of system where children were actually being cared for in a developmentally appropriate way. And the solution to that, of course, is to keep these children with their parents and guardians. And if their parents and guardians are unavailable, then you put them directly with their U.S.-based sponsors, you know, where you have families and folks that are ready to welcome these children.
And we have reports of sponsors and community support people who are being, you know, pushed away. They're being denied access. They get told no. You know, they have forms that you need to fill out that aren't available. You know, very specific deadlines and other things. You know, you have a system which is broken, you know, and this is it's going to sound kind of like I'm going to sound like a conservative, but this is where you have the government process, the classic government process that's super broken and has nothing to do with the real world. And they're just pushing papers around and they're not actually doing anything.
I would argue here from the other perspective that this was intentionally broken.
Oh, it's engineered that way. I would definitely grant you that. But the outcome is this ineffective government. But that, you know, that's where
we're at. So have you also heard the argument that, well, concentration camp is a hyperbole because we're not actually gassing the children?
Well, and
that's something that incensed the hell out of me.
Well, and, you know, I've heard even from people who aren't Jewish, who don't really understand what's going on, but they're trying to latch on to this idea. And, you know, partially the some of the board members of the main Holocaust Museum were like, yeah, don't compare these to concentration camps because they're really old Republicans that, you know, are looking at this through a political lens and not through their own lens that they're supposed to be looking at this thing through. You know, they're saying, well, you know, you can't call it concentration camps because that's going to diminish the history of the Holocaust and what happened to the Jews and other you know, other cultures within Nazi Germany. And it's just, this
as someone
not,
as someone with a direct heritage line to folks that were affected by Nazi concentration camps, I can understand, and I do understand, that the Holocaust and Jewish people do not own a history of concentration camps. There are concentration camps and work camps and detainment camps all over the world in lots of different conflicts. And when you have experts that have researched and studied and lectured on this topic,
almost saying, 500 of them,
yes, these are the definition of concentration camps. We are concentrating people in inhumane conditions. You know, I would say, screw that perspective.
Yeah.
You know, we can say that, in fact, one's heritage and connection to the Holocaust and the Nazi concentration camps should further motivate you to protest and be incensed by these kinds of things. So, I am happy to say that many people who have those kinds of connections, be they religious or not, are very much coming out against these things and really demanding action. But I want to look now about, how is this an atheist or humanist issue? Now, do you guys feel that this is an atheist or humanist issue?
Well, atheism is not a worldview, but there's nothing about atheism that's going to preclude me from, you know, being involved, you know, and really it's more of a secular humanist issue. I mean, it's a humanist issue, secular or not, but it's definitely part of that. It falls under that mission.
Yeah. What do you think, Dan?
I'm in the same boat on that one. Not really relevant to atheism, but certainly to humanism. This is a human rights violation. This is something where the United Nations has come out and said, this situation is illegal. This is not acceptable. We cannot, we should not treat human beings this way, period.
One of the really neat things about secular humanists is that we have kind of a guiding document that has changed over the years. We've got Humanist Manifesto 3, which is called Humanism and Its Aspirations. And knowing that not every secular humanist abides or agrees with every single one of these points and every single one of these aspirations, there are some that really speak to me on this issue. It's a definition of humanism guided by reason, inspired by compassion, and informed by experience. If you can't look at the experience that we've had as a human culture and use that to inform what our further actions should be, if you can't use compassion to inspire you, and if you can't use reason and logic to be guided in how we address this, then I don't know that there would be much value in calling yourself a secular humanist, but that's my personal opinion.
Or even a humanist. I mean, you know, even the non-secular humanists still use, you know, reason and empathy and experience to guide their decisions.
We look at aspirations that say humanists ground values in human welfare shaped by human circumstances, interests, and concerns, and extended to the global ecosystem and beyond. We know that this migration is not just based on violence, but and escaping violence. We know that it's not just about escaping, you know, drug cartels. We also know that our resources, our natural resources, and access to them, and who controls them, you know, is one of the propelling factors in migration worldwide, whether they be in the Americas or elsewhere. We know that access to those kinds of resources will only become tighter as we have different climate change effects happening in different parts of our world. And so I think that when we look at this, this isn't just about crying for the child that is locked in a dog cage. This is also recognizing the human-made condition that we have placed upon ourselves. You know, we look at other aspirations like humanists long for and strive toward a world of mutual care and concern, free of cruelty and its consequences. We look at the joining of individuality with interdependence and how it enriches our lives, encourages us to enrich the lives of others, and inspires hope of attaining peace and justice and opportunity for all. You know, we seek to minimize inequities of circumstance and ability. We support a just distribution of nature's resources and the fruits of human effort so that as many as possible can enjoy a good life. And we are concerned for the well-being of all and are committed to diversity and respect those of differing yet humane views. So all of those together really motivate me and put me in a position that is a little bit different from other kinds of circumstances that I've encountered in my life. You're listening to Ask an Atheist, and I think we've got, now that we've looked at the problem, I want to come back after the break with what are the kinds of things that we can do? How can we actually address this? Hello and welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Whew. It's a little bit of a rough segment we had there for me personally, but way less rough than what our migrant families and individuals are experiencing. So there are some really neat things that are going on around the country. One thing that I wanted to let folks know about is this Friday, Lights for Liberty events will take place around the nation at 9 p.m. local time. And in our state, there are events organized for at least 36 different locations, including Tacoma's Union Station and the Northwest Detention Center. There are several places in Seattle and in our capital of Olympia. And from the website Lights for Liberty, a vigil to end human concentration camps, they aim to bring thousands of people together in key locations, including detention centers and concentration camps across the country, into the streets and into their own front yards to protest the inhumane conditions faced by the migrants. And you can find more info at lightsforliberty.org. I think the general idea, and it may take different shapes in different cities, but it's something that you can do on your own. And through the power of social media, is even just step out your front door and have your candle as a vigil. You can post it to social media and have a movement in that sense. We'll post also on atheist.radio some of the different organizations that have different suggestions for how one can participate in protesting and then affecting change. And I'll let you know that even we as atheists, you know, I won't shy away from posting suggestions from the American Friends Service Committee. That's a Quaker organization known for pacifism and activism. But there's things like posters that you can download and put in your yards that say things like keep loved ones together, stop ICE, abolish ICE, sanctuary everywhere, things like that. A lot of people have downloadable Know Your Rights resources within your community for supporting individuals that are already in the United States. Things at the ACLU websites and United We Dream have those, and I'll post all links to those at atheist.radio. We've also talked about different places where folks may want to put their money where their mouth is, or at least where my mouth is. And I'll post links to those as well, but some of them are Raices. That's one of the ones that's most... most widely shared, and that's an organization in Texas that specifically works for on both sides of the border. There's also Kids in Need of Defense, we've talked about before, and there's any kinds of places, you know, local to your own place or across the country. There's Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center. There's Justice for Our Neighbors. There's Asylum Seeker Advocacy Project. Here in Tacoma, I want to give a shout out to one of the organizations that's done so much footwork and groundwork, and that really centers the voices of affected individuals, both indigenous to our communities here and migrants. And that is La Resistencia. You may have known them by Northwest Detention Center Resistance, or Resistencia al Northwest Detention Center. Al Centro de Detención, but right now they're going by La Resistencia, both in social media and on their website. But there's been a tremendous number of events and a lot of footwork that's been done by that group regarding our particular detention center here that has been in existence for a great long time in a place in the Tide Flats that's not even zoned for overnight occupancy. You can't build a hotel there. You can't build housing there. But Geo Group, the private contracting facility under the contract with Homeland Defense, what is it? Has essentially built a jail there where you definitely have overnight occupancy, even though ordinarily it wouldn't be a place that would be permitted. So again, you can find all those things at atheist.radio, extensive different lists and links and things like that if you'd like to become involved. I think I will be there this Friday, either at Union Station or at Northwest Detention Center, and you can join me if you wish. So that's some tough ones. I want to bring us to something that is a little bit lighter hearted to wrap up our hour here today, guys, because in the midst of all of these things, there are some things that we secular humanists and atheists can definitely agree with individuals on, like don't put children in dog cages. But there's some things that I don't think we will ever agree on. Country singer Leanne Rimes is receiving blowback from Christian fans because she failed to capitalize the letter G in a new tattoo that reads God's work in lowercase cursive. Rimes revealed the tattoo placed on her inner wrist on her Instagram. This 36-year-old country star attends Life Change Community Church in California, a congregation associated with stars like Caitlyn Jenner and the Kardashian family. Guys, on a scale of 0 to 5, how important is capitalizing the G when you refer to God?
Well, I mean, which God? Like, right. Dionysus, I don't think she's like a major God. I mean, where's the, you know, Thor? Is that one enough to be capitalized? I mean, I guess we capitalized Thursday, so I don't know.
Right, yeah. I mean, I think if you got a day, you got to get capitalized.
Okay. So Woden's out. That's fine.
So
No. Woden's Wednesday.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying, yeah.
So of all the things to freak out about, you know, I mean, you could decide to protest about, you know, children that are being detained from their parents, but no, a country artist that you like, who also happens to be actively Christian and attend a big mega church for folks in the Southern California area.
That part doesn't matter. It's the tattoo and the uppercase, lowercase language. That part matters, obviously.
I mean, if you're really going to go, like, buy the actual Bible, you should probably go with Leviticus 19:28, which says you should not make any cuttings in your flesh for the dead, nor tattoo any marks upon your skin.
So this is a really funny thing.
I am
thing.
The Lord.
Oh, who are you now, Dave?
we went over this earlier.
So one of the funniest loopholes from some of my friends who look to, in a very Talmudic way circumvent the very specific and seemingly obvious rules that are appearing in the five books of Moses is to say, no, I can get a tattoo. It just can't be in memory of someone. You know, I can do ritual scarification. It just can't be for someone who died in memory. So if it's like, oh, I don't know if I wanted to have a, and we all know that, hey guys, God's not dead. So it's perfectly fine to have a tattoo honoring God, because
but not Jesus, even if you're a messianic Jew, because he died. Oh, wait, no, but
he came back to life. So
oh, no, it's okay. Just for those 3 days, you couldn't have a tattoo. Huh. Okay. There you go.
So what do you guys think of a God's work tattoo? Is that I wanted to add a little T there. Like, I was really hoping that there would be a cross there and it would end up being like God's twerk or something like that. You know,
God's twerk.
Well, that's the Christian Life International with the little cross.
Yeah, we saw some of those along social media, the ill-placed crosses. Doesn't seem like Leanne Rimes had any ill-placed crosses, only ill-placed G's. So would you guys get a tattoo that would include lowercase, you know, cursive anywhere?
Lowercase Sagan. Oh, yep. It looks the same either way. I don't know.
Maybe this is a reflection of my age. I am 39 and 2 months old. Even when I text, I really adhere to the rules of grammar. I capitalize. I use commas and quotation marks and semicolons and periods and question marks and exclamation points. And I have difficulty adapting to text speak where you know use the letter R and then the letter U to say are you something.
Well, it's
just not my way.
That's out of practice now with autocomplete. So
right, no,
speech to text does a lot of funny things.
Right. And so if I were to get a tattoo, the only way that I think I could do it lowercase is if it started with an ellipsis and was in quotation marks.
Got it. Well, if you go to atheist.radio, you can capitalize it or not capitalize it because, oh, I don't know, that's our website. But you are listening to Ask an Atheist with Dan with a capital D and Nathan with a capital N and Becky with a capital B. Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Thank you to Chris Coleman and Phil Whitfield for our music. Thank you to all of our listeners. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Ask an Atheist WA. We'll see you guys next week.